All right, ready to dive deep. Today, it's all about the geography of the Holy Land.
Ooh, that's a big one.
It is. And we've got a great guide, Dr. Jeffrey Hudin's lectures on biblical archaeology. It's amazing how much geography impacts those stories.
Oh, absolutely. It's not just about place names. It's about understanding the landscape, the climate, how they shaped people's lives back then.
Okay, so picture this. The Plain of Sharon, right along the Mediterranean. You'd think prime farmland, right? Sun, sea.
You'd think so, wouldn't you? But there's this curveball, the Kirkar Ridge.
Kirkar Ridge.
Yeah. It's a ridge of fossilized sea creatures, basically. And it blocked those streams from reaching the sea. So what happens? Swamps. Lots of swamps.
So not exactly a breadbasket, even with that coastline. How did that affect travel?
Well, imagine trying to move goods with all those swampy patches. The Via Maris, that major trade route, had to detour inland.
An ancient detour, huh? I bet there were some grumbles back then. But okay, so maybe not great for farming, but I'm guessing the plain still had its advantages.
Definitely. Think port cities.
Ah, right. Access to the Mediterranean.
Exactly. Dor, a major Phoenician city, was a big player in sea trade.
And I bet Herod had something to do with this, right?
Oh, you know Herod. Always had to make a statement. Caesarea Maritima. That was his baby.
Caesarea Maritima. What was so special about it?
He took a small existing port and went all out. Artificial harbor, aqueduct system to bring fresh water from Mount Carmel. Basically, built a show-off city.
He did love his big projects.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Anything to impress. But there's another interesting site in that area. Tel Kassili.
Tel Kassili.
It's a Philistine site near what's now Tel Aviv. Most Philistine cities were built on, you know, destroyed Canaanite settlements. But not this one. Built on virgin land.
Ah, so a pure look at Philistine culture.
Exactly. A blank slate.
Fascinating. Okay, so we've got our swampy but strategically important coastal plain. Where to next?
Let's head inland up into the hill country, the heartland of ancient Israel.
The hill country. Yeah. So all those scenes in the Bible with the vineyards, the olive groves.
That's it. Rolling hills, terraced for olive and grape cultivation, valleys perfect for growing grain. And the soil, it's incredible. Reddish soil called terra rasa, formed from a specific kind of limestone. Super fertile.
So that terra rasa, that was their agricultural secret weapon.
You could say that. It's amazing how something like soil can shape an entire civilization.
It really is. And speaking of shaping civilizations, what have archaeologists found in this area?
Oh, the hill country is an archaeological goldmine, especially for understanding how Israel became a nation. Folks like Adam Zertl, Israel Finkelstein, they've made groundbreaking discoveries here.
It's like piecing together a giant historical jigsaw puzzle, isn't it? Mm. Are there any sites in the hill country that stand out in terms of, you know, biblical significance?
Absolutely. Let's start with the Dothan Valley.
Dothan Valley.
Yeah, that's where the story of Joseph being sold into slavery by his brothers takes place.
Wait, so we know the actual location. That's incredible.
It is, isn't it? Although there is a darker side to that location as well. Yeah, during World War II, when the Africa Corps was advancing, you know, the Dothan Valley was actually the planned location for Nazi extermination camps, targeting Palestine's Jewish population.
Wow, that sends chills down my spine. It adds a whole other layer of meaning to that landscape.
Definitely.
So what other cities in this region are worth exploring?
Samaria, also known as Sebastia, is a fascinating one. King Omri built it, and then Jeroboam II expanded it. Very strategic location.
What about Shechem? It rings a bell, but...
Shechem is nestled between Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal, the mountains of blessings and curses.
Ah, yes, of course.
He became the first capital of the divided kingdom of Israel after Solomon died. Lots of history there.
So what kind of discoveries have they made at Shechem?
There's this fascinating story about Adam Zertl, the archaeologist. He claimed to have found Joshua's altar on Mount Ebal. It's still debated, you know, what the structure actually is, but the impact it had on Israeli soldiers was pretty remarkable, even those who weren't particularly religious.
Wait, what happened with the soldiers?
Well, Zertl, he was a war veteran himself, and he would take these soldiers to the site, explain his findings, and it was really powerful. Many of them felt this renewed sense of faith, you know, connecting with that tangible evidence of history in a very personal way.
Wow, that's incredible. Okay, so we've explored the Plain of Sharon, climbed into the hill country, unearthed some incredible historical gems. Where to next?
Let's head south to the Philistine plain.
The Philistines, always a formidable presence in the Bible. What kind of discoveries have been made in their cities?
Well, at Tel Mitzi, the site of Ekron, they've uncovered a massive temple palace complex and a monumental inscription. Really changed our understanding of Philistine culture. And Telesafi, which is Gath.
Goliath's a hometown?
Exactly. They found an incredible four-horned altar there.
A four-horned altar. Wow. What about the other cities? Ashkelon, Gaza.
Ashkelon has a well-funded excavation site. They've found a stunning Middle Bronze Age gateway and a really interesting silver calf figurine. Gaza, though, hasn't seen as much excavation due to, you know, political complexities, but what they have found is promising.
It's amazing how each city offers its own little window into the past. Okay, so we've followed in the footsteps of the patriarchs, stood on those terraced hillsides, explored the remains of mighty Philistine cities. What's next?
Eastward, away from the fertile plains, into the wilderness of Judah.
The wilderness of Judah. That sounds pretty desolate. Are we talking like barren, empty desert?
Not quite. Not a true desert. It's more of a dry, rocky region east of the Philistine plain. The Hebrew word midbar, meaning steppe, is a better description. Think dry, rocky, but not completely lifeless.
Okay, so rugged, dry, but not a wasteland. What makes this region so important then for biblical history and archaeology?
The wilderness of Judah is like a giant time capsule. The dry climate has preserved ancient remains incredibly well, including the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Ah, the Dead Sea Scrolls. What a find.
And get ready for a dramatic change in elevation. We're talking a drop from 2,500 feet to 1,400 feet below sea level.
Whoa, that's a big drop.
It creates what's called a rain shadow effect.
Rain shadow.
Think of the mountains like a wall blocking the rain clouds. As the clouds rise to pass over the mountains, they dump most of their moisture on the windward side. So the leeward side, the wilderness of Judah, ends up much drier.
So the mountains are playing weather games, creating two completely different climates. It makes you realize how much geography dictates what a region can be. Okay, so we're descending, descending. What's waiting for us at the bottom of that drop?
The lowest point on Earth. The Dead Sea.
Ah, the Dead Sea. I have heard of that one.
Imagine a sea so salty you can practically float on it. It's shrinking rapidly, though, which is a big concern.
So what makes it so special besides being super salty?
Well, for one, it's about 10 times saltier than the ocean. But its mineral-rich mud is said to have health benefits. People have been flocking there for centuries for that very reason.
A salty spa, basically. What kind of historical or archaeological sites are around the Dead Sea?
There's the Engedi Temple with its chalcolithic finds. That's Copper Age, by the way. And then there's Masada.
Masada, the mountaintop fortress.
Built by, you guessed it, Herod the Great. It became the last stand of the Jewish zealots during the revolt against the Romans.
What a story. What a setting for a last stand.
It really is. A tale of courage against all odds.
Okay, so we've braved the wilderness of Judah, experienced the wonders of the Dead Sea. Where to now?
Let's shift gears a bit. From cliffs and salt to spiritual retreats. The wilderness of Judah is also home to a surprising number of Byzantine-era monasteries.
Monasteries in the wilderness, that's an interesting combination.
We've got the Monastery of the Temptation, dramatically perched on a cliff face, marking where Jesus was tempted in the wilderness. And then there's Mars Saba, carved into the cliffside itself, one of the oldest continuously occupied monasteries in the world.
Centuries of history etched into those walls.
And then there's the Wadi Kelt, a deep gorge carved out by a seasonal river with St. George's Monastery nestled within its walls. Tradition says that's where Elijah hid from King Ahab and Jezebel.
Sounds like a place of incredible beauty and spiritual significance.
Oh, it is. And then there's the Bukiya Valley, or Valley of Achor.
Valley of Achor.
It was used for paramilitary farmsteads back in the 9th and 8th centuries BC. Gives you a sense of how strategic even these seemingly desolate areas were.
So the wilderness of Judah, despite being rugged, has played a major role in history. Refuge, spiritual retreat, military advantage. It's more than just a wilderness, isn't it?
It really is. And speaking of historical significance, let's end this part of our journey in the Jordan Valley at a place that's been drawing people in for millennia.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Spill beans, where are we headed? Okay, you've got me on the edge of my seat. What is this final stop in the Jordan Valley?
Jericho, the lowest city on earth.
Jericho. Wow, another name I see all the time in the Bible. What makes it so special besides that record low elevation?
Well, it's in the Jordan Valley, right? So you'd think it'd be, you know, dry and barren.
Yeah, makes sense.
But Jericho is actually incredibly lush and green. It's all thanks to Elisha's spring, a constant source of fresh water.
Elisha's spring. A real oasis, then. What have archaeologists learned about Jericho's past?
Excavations by Kathleen Kenyon back in the 1950s, they revealed layers upon layers of history, going all the way back to the Neolithic period. like 9,000 BC.
Whoa, 9,000 BC. Wow.
Even before the events in the Bible.
It is. It makes Jericho one of the oldest continuously inhabited cities in the world.
That's mind-blowing. What did they find from that super early period?
One of the most impressive discoveries is the remains of a massive stone tower, estimated to have been built around 8,000 BC.
A tower from 8,000 BC? What was it used for?
That's still debated. Defense. Gathering spot. We're still working on that puzzle. But it's clearly a very important structure.
It's amazing that something built so long ago can still hold so many secrets.
It is. What about the Jericho from the Bible, though, the one we read about in the stories? Is there any evidence that connects to those accounts?
Yes, actually. Excavations have revealed different layers, showing distinct periods in the city's history. They've found city walls, gates, houses, all dating back to the time of the Israelite conquest, as described in the book of Joshua.
So the archaeology seems to support the biblical account of Jericho's destruction.
Well, there's one finding that sparked a lot of discussion. There's a lack of evidence for a major destruction event in the late Bronze Age, which is when the Israelite conquest is traditionally thought to have happened.
Wait, so no evidence for the destruction of Jericho? That sounds like a pretty big contradiction.
It's not quite that simple. Just because we haven't found evidence yet, you know, doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Right.
It's possible it's out there waiting to be discovered.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could have been eroded away over time.
So the exact timing and details are still up for debate.
Right.
But it's clear that Jericho is a vital part of both biblical history and archaeology. What would you say is the biggest takeaway about Jericho?
I think what makes Jericho so fascinating is that it represents this unbroken thread of human history, you know? Spanning millennia. From its early days as a Neolithic village to its role in the biblical stories, Jericho is a testament to human resilience, adapting and enduring through changing empires, evolving cultures.
It's a reminder that even in ancient ruins, we can find reflections of ourselves.
Absolutely.
It's been an incredible journey so far, but I'm sensing we're not done yet. There's more to discover.
You're right. Our deep dive isn't over. Remember those monasteries we talked about? In the wilderness of Judah?
Yeah, those cliff-dwelling monasteries.
We're going to take a closer look at one in particular, Mars Saba.
Mars Saba, that's the one that's been continuously occupied for, what, over 1,500 years?
That's the one. And it's an absolutely stunning place. Imagine a monastery carved right into the sheer cliff face of a steep canyon. Looks like something out of an Indiana Jones movie.
Okay, you've definitely got my attention. What makes Mars Saba so unique, so historically significant?
Well, it was founded by a monk named Sabas. Back in the 5th century AD, he was known for his piety and wisdom. People flocked to him from all over the Byzantine Empire.
So this Sabas guy, he was like a celebrity monk.
You could say that. He had quite a following. And the monastery he founded, it thrived long after his death, continuously occupied for over 1,500 years. It's pretty mind-blowing when you think about it.
That is incredible. What's life like inside this cliff-dwelling monastery?
It's still a functioning monastery today. Home to a community of Orthodox monks. They live a simple life dedicated to prayer and contemplation. They're incredibly hospitable, too. They welcome visitors, though women are only allowed in a specific outer courtyard.
Ah, so some ancient traditions are still very much alive there.
They are.
What kind of challenges have the monks faced over the centuries, though, living in that remote location?
Oh, they've had to deal with everything. Earthquakes, flash floods, raids by Bedouins, political upheaval. But through it all, they've managed to hold on to their way of life, clinging to that cliff face, just like the monastery itself.
Sounds like a place where time has almost stood still.
It does, doesn't it?
Are there any stories or legends connected to Mars Saba?
Oh, absolutely. One legend says that Sabas himself once encountered a lion while walking through the wilderness. And instead of attacking, the lion approached him gently and asked for help. It had a thorn stuck in its paw. Sabas removed the thorn, and the lion became his loyal companion.
Wow, that's a great story.
It is.
But what about the political side of things? I mean, given its location, its history, has Mars Saba been caught up in any conflicts over the centuries?
Yes, unfortunately. Control of the monastery has changed hands many times. Different empires, religious factions vying for power. It's been a source of tension, especially in more recent times, you know, with the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
It's a reminder that even a place dedicated to peace, to spirituality, the outside world can still intrude.
Exactly. And that's part of what makes Mars Saba so fascinating, I think. It's a place where history, religion, politics, they all come together.
So you've got these ancient monasteries clinging to the cliffs, caught between the timeless rhythms of monastic life and the ever-shifting tides of history. What a powerful image.
It is. And speaking of powerful images, there's another site near Jericho that we need to explore. The Mount of Temptation.
The Mount of Temptation. Now, that's a name that carries some weight.
It does.
What's it like to actually visit this site?
Well, it's a pretty dramatic climb to the top. You can either hike up a steep path or take a cable car. But once you're there, the views are just breathtaking. You can see the entire Jordan Valley stretching out before you, all the way to the Dead Sea, shimmering in the distance.
Sounds like a place where you could really feel a sense of, I don't know, solitude, connection to something bigger than yourself.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And perched right on the edge of this sheer cliff, you'll find the Greek Orthodox Monastery of the Temptation. Built in the 6th century AD. It's like something out of a dream, honestly. A testament to faith, to perseverance.
I'm picturing this monastery clinging to the cliffside, almost defying gravity. Are there any particular features of the monastery that stand out?
One of the most striking is the chapel, built into a cave. According to tradition, this is where Jesus sought refuge during his time in the wilderness. The monks who live there today consider it a sacred space, and you can feel that reverence when you're there.
It must be incredibly moving to visit a place so steeped in history and spiritual significance.
It really is. And as you stand there on the Mount of Temptation, gazing out over this barren landscape, you can't help but feel a sense of awe, of wonder. It's a place that challenges you to confront your own inner demons, you know, to reflect on the choices you make, to consider the power of faith in the face of adversity.
Wow. That's a powerful message. The Mount of Temptation, it sounds like it's more than just a historical site. It's a place that speaks to something deep within us all.
Exactly. And it's just one of the many incredible sites we have left to explore on our deep dive into the geography of the Holy Land.
Okay, I am ready for more. What other hidden gems are we uncovering? All right, lead the way. What other hidden gems are we uncovering?
Well, let's talk about a valley that might not be as famous as, you know, Jericho or the Mount of Temptation.
Yeah.
But it's incredibly significant in its own right. The Valley of Achor.
The Valley of Achor. Okay, help me out here. What's the story there?
Remember Achan from the Book of Joshua?
Vaguely.
He took some forbidden loot after the conquest of Jericho. And that act, you know, it brought disaster on the Israelites.
Ah, right, right. And he was punished, right?
He was. And the stolen goods were burned in this valley. Hence the name Achor, which means trouble in Hebrew.
So this valley, it holds a pretty dark history. What's it like today?
It's actually a beautiful valley, very fertile, which, you know, makes that dark history even more poignant. And what's fascinating is that archaeologists have found evidence of paramilitary farmsteads dating back to the 9th and 8th centuries BC in this valley.
Paramilitary farmstead. Okay, now I'm really curious. What does that even mean?
It means these weren't just your average farms. These settlements were strategically located, fortified, suggests they served a dual purpose, agriculture and defense.
So part-time farmers, part-time soldiers.
Exactly.
That's a tough life. What does that tell us about the Valley of Achor?
It tells us that even though it was associated with this, you know, this dark event in biblical history, it was still a strategically important area. People were willing to settle there, cultivate the land, and protect it.
It's another reminder that the geography of the Holy Land, it's more than just pretty scenery. These locations, they're intertwined with these stories of conflict, faith, resilience. It really paints a vivid picture of life back then.
It does. And as we wrap up our deep dive, I think that's a key takeaway. It's not just about knowing, you know, where things are on a map. It's about understanding how the landscape shaped the lives, the stories of the people who lived there.
It's like we've been on this incredible journey, tracing the footsteps of patriarchs, kings, prophets, everyday people. And the landscape itself has been our guide.
And what's amazing is that, you know, the discoveries we've discussed, they're just a small glimpse. The Holy Land is a treasure trove of archaeological wonders. And every new find, it adds another layer to our understanding of the past.
It really makes you realize how much we still don't know, how much there is still to discover.
Exactly. And as we conclude our journey today, I want to encourage you, the listener, to keep exploring, whether you delve deeper into the books and research we've mentioned, or even, you know, have the opportunity to visit the Holy Land yourself, there's always something new to uncover, a new perspective to gain.
This deep dive has really opened my eyes to the power of place, how it shapes history, culture, faith. I feel like I have a much deeper appreciation for the stories, the events that unfolded in this extraordinary region.
It's been a pleasure sharing this journey with you.
And to you, our listener, thank you for joining us on this exploration. Until next time, keep that spirit of curiosity alive.